Good evening. This is Franz Weinschenk, your host on Valley Writers Read. Delighted to welcome you to another edition of our program. And tonight, it's all about the San Joaquin River. After hearing this evening's stories, I'm sure you'll agree that not only are they interesting, but historically relevant as well. Yes, tonight's program is all about the river that runs right through our valley, the great San Joaquin, all about the many folks who, from the late 18th century to modern times, lived right out there by the river. You see, just recently, Coke Halliwell and her daughter Joelle published a book entitled Take Me to the River. It chronicles the stories of many different people who at one time or another lived right by the San Joaquin and remember what that neighborhood was like and what effects the river had on their lives. And we've got four fine readers to read 10 excerpts from the book. Elise Moyer will be reading stories by Emily Sample and Irene Takahashi. Coke Halliwell, the co-author of the book, will be reading a story by Peg Smith. Donna Mott will be reading stories by Viola Adlish and Thelma Russell. And Kevin Statham will be reading stories by Everard Jones, Bud Rank, Ken Homan, Elmer Hansen, and Bernie Salado. And so now to get us started, here is Elise Moyer reading an excerpt from a story by Emily Sample, taken from Take Me to the River by Coke and Joelle Halliwell.
Emily Sample. I spent all my childhood summers by the river. It would be so hot that all us Indians would go down to the river to camp, right above where the dam is now. There were lots of willows and oaks, and it was cooler there. We'd start camping in June and stay through August until the grape harvest started. During that time, my dad and the other men would all go off to work at different farms, while the women and children stayed by the river. It was great for the kids. We really had fun. I remember the salmon. They were bright pink. I learned to swim in the river, too. Indians are very resourceful. They find good ways to do things. Our mothers would cook over a campfire. They'd find a big flat rock to lay out the laundry, and we rubbed the clothes. Then we'd hang them on the bushes to dry. The men would come home from work, and they'd get up a party to fish for salmon at night, with lanterns, from a boat. They would go spearing all night. They would see the shine of the fish by the lantern light. At that time, it was legal for us Indians to spear, but nobody else was allowed. In the morning, the women would work on the fish all day. They'd cut them into long strips, lay the fillets over ropes or wires, and let the fish hang out and dry in the sun. When it was all done, they'd sack them up and have salmon for the whole winter. During the Depression in the 1930s, my dad would pan for gold with my brother along the banks of the river, on the slopes. They'd cut tunnels way back, bring out the dirt, and then wash it in the river. He'd take the gold to the post office in Fryant and get enough cash to buy food for the day. Food wasn't very expensive in those days. I remember a big Indian event along the river when I was 11 or 12 years old. It was what they called a fandango. Invitations went to tribes from North Fork to Lemoore. We camped along the river, and there were lots of games. Hand games and races, horse racing, and people racing. There was lots to eat, traditional foods, and we danced and sang Indian songs. Each tribe had their own songs, but they all knew each other's songs, too. I don't know how many were there, because I was just a small child, but it seemed like many hundreds of people. My mother got all of the things she needed to make baskets by the banks of the river. She'd gather white roots along the river where it was sandy. She took roots from the sedge and used red bud to make the red part of the design. She used the sourberry for the picking baskets and deer grass for tying the roots. It was hard work, but my mother really enjoyed making baskets. I remember she'd sit on the ground by the river under one of those big umbrella trees. It could take 3 or 4 months to make one basket. She worked at it every day. When the dam was built, the salmon couldn't get upstream anymore. I had one of my babies during that last salmon run. Some of the boys in our family went out to fish one last time. I remember it well. Because when Indians have a new baby, they aren't allowed to have any fish or meat or any kind of fat. So my brothers came in with all these salmon and said, "Oh no, sister can't eat our fish." I remember my mother making beans for me. Just beans. No salt or seasonings are allowed either. I didn't get to eat any while everybody else ate that last catch of salmon from the San Joaquin River. I missed that.
Everard Jones. I know Everard is a strange name, a hard one to pronounce. Everard, A-R-D. Most people want to call me Everett, and it's all the same to me. You can call me whatever you want. My only interest here is in giving the fish some recognition. That's why I wanted to tell you some of my stories. I would say that maybe 75% of the people living in this area now don't even know that salmon ever came up here. The salmon would come through the Golden Gate, all the way up. Sure, some of them would go up into the Tuolumne River and the Merced River, but this was their main river. Right in these riffles, Rank's Riffle and Cobb's Riffle, that's where the salmon would start to spawn. Of course, that's why they came up the river in the first place. My gosh, the fish. The fish were everywhere, and I had the good luck of being right here at the right time.
Viola Adlish. They call this area Temperance Flat. My grandparents homesteaded the property sometime in the 1890s. They came up here to mine. They mined from the river and from the creeks and out of the ground anywhere they could find gold. They dug dozens of tunnels all over the property. There was a lot of gold back then. My grandfather died in 1919, and my grandmother was left raising their children, 3 girls and 4 boys. Then later that same year, my mother died. So Grandma took me and my 2 brothers, and she did most of our raising, too. It was 1919 when I moved out here by the river. I was only 6 months old. My family did real well finding gold, and they kept mining right up until the late 1920s, right up until the crash. While they still had their gold money, my grandparents always had the latest thing, Model Ts and all. But then they'd put all of their money in the bank, and then the banks went broke. Of course, you've heard about all that. Anyway, that's what happened to our family's gold money. It was gone. We did okay, though. We had a herd of goats that went up to the top of Table Mountain. When I was a teenager, it was my job to go up there before I went to school and shag the goats, run them back down to the house. We sure liked that goat meat, and Grandma really fixed it good. We didn't have refrigeration, but Grandma could fit a half a goat into her big oven. We always ate well. My uncles carried guns with them, and they'd shoot food for the table. A rabbit, a quail, dove, anything that was edible. Grandma would cash in some gold pieces, and we'd buy fresh peaches from an orchard down in Fryant. She'd can them, so we'd always have peaches all year round. We ate pretty good food up here. My grandma lived to be 90. She was always a tough lady, right up to the end. When fishermen wanted to come down our road, Grandma would send her grandchildren out to stand at the road and collect 50 cents. She made the fishermen pay to go on her property. Good for her. This property has always been pretty isolated. When we first got married, my husband hated it up here. He was a city guy. But later, I was given a little piece of this property, and I told him, "I'm moving back up there." He said, "Well, I guess I'll have to go too." Now I'm alone most of the time, but I still love it. One evening last summer, I was sitting in my rocking chair, and here's this darn rattlesnake right at my feet in my living room. I tried to put him in a paper bag so I could dump him outside, but he wouldn't go for that. I ended up having to kill him with a shovel. Since then, I'm always looking down, even in the house. It's pretty rugged living, that's true, but I couldn't live anyplace else. It's like I live on my own little island.
Bud Rank. It was the mid-1930s when the Bureau of Reclamation started coming around and conducting surveys, and we got an indication of what was coming. When I say we, I mean the farmers and ranchers along the river. We started to understand what they were planning on doing with the dam. We believe we had a right to keep the river as it was, a beautiful and majestic stream. But then suddenly, the government was planning on damming it all off, stopping all the water down the river. The farmers fought for years to stop that from happening, and they were able to protect some of the water. But the last salmon run we had was in 1947. My good friends came out, and the three of us put the boat up the river, and we speared salmon all night. We filled that boat up. Honest, what a night we had. That was the last time that the salmon ever came up the river. It was dry then, from Mendota, from Gravelly Ford on down. They put the dam in, and that was it.
Thelma Russell.
My father's uncle came to this area about 5 years after the gold rush started. And then my dad came with his dad and brother to work here. I came later on a boat from Spain when I was 3 years old. We were Spanish Castilian and we lived in Fresno for a while because there were quite a few Basque people living there. But then we moved to Kerman up on the last road along the river. It was way far out there. My uncle had a little dairy on a river's edge, and it was so close to the river that, well, when it flowed high, the cows were right out there standing in the water. I tell you, honey, those were really hard times then. My dad had found an old house up on the hill that had been abandoned, kind of like a hillbilly's home. My dad was only making a dollar a day, but my mom, she knew how to use her head. We had a few chickens, we had some pigeons, and my dad built a coop high enough so the cats wouldn't get at them. We had to climb the ladder to get to the squabs, and that's what we ate to keep us going. We had to walk about 4 miles to school, and there was a French family that we walked with. Their mother was real sweet. She knew we didn't have anything to eat, so she'd have her boys carry an old lard bucket filled with chocolate milk up to our house. And sometimes she'd send her oldest boy, the smartest one, to come looking for us at school to make sure we had something to eat. He'd bring us food, maybe a piece of bread or something, because they knew we were hungry. Now, I haven't always lived on the river. I've lived all around the valley, but I'll tell you a story about when my husband and I moved back out there again by the river. One year they said that we could spear salmon legally. I didn't like to fish, and when my husband said, "Let's go spearing," well, I didn't like that idea much. You were only allowed 2 salmon each, so I had to go if we wanted to get more fish. We were all down there to Las Banas, where the river crosses right before you get into town. There were a lot of people, since everybody wanted to get a chance to spear again. Our good friends from Biola made me a spear at the end of a long pipe. I got into the river, but I was scared to death. We were in the water up to our knees. The salmon were coming upstream, and they told me I had to spear the salmon before the fish got to me. The spear had a string tied to the pole so the fish couldn't get away, and you had to throw it hard enough to make it stick. And I got one. That was quite an achievement for me. That's one of those times I'll always remember. It was quite an experience. It really was.
Thelma Ken Homan. I decided to graduate from high school a little early, so I was still only 17 years old in July of 1941 when I went to find work on the Friant Dam. Union rules stipulated that all employees shall be a minimum of 21 years, but somehow I was plugged in as an exception. I was assigned to what was called the batch plant. That's where all the goodies were mixed in a very deliberate and precise fashion in order to manufacture mud, commonly known as concrete. Now, you need lots of mud to make a dam the size of Friant. It was very exciting to be part of such a big project, building a dam. I was paid a dollar an hour. I have no idea what my job title was. Basically, I was a dumper. I made sure that there was a can down below me. I would flip a lever and throw 4 yards of mud down the chute. That was it. The whole production was quite a scene. There were 4 of these cans on every donkey train. The cans were huge, 10 feet high and weighing 9 tons. We made a batch every 9.5 minutes. That's an awful lot of mud. The crane operator couldn't always see what he was doing, so they had whistle boys down next to the cans. There were about 5 men in high rubber boots that operated in the mud, dumping it in a controlled fashion, back and forth, and they would vibrate the blocks to eliminate airspace. After the pour was completed, they'd smooth it off and let it cure. There were 1,600 men working on Friant Dam, on 4 shifts per day. It was like a 3-ring circus. I was in awe of that spectacle. I was assigned to the dormitory. I had my little fake alligator suitcase, and my folks had bought me a couple sets of suntans and 1 pair of work shoes. I was wearing glasses at the time, and that wasn't fun in games. There was cement everywhere. At the end of the shift, I couldn't see through my glasses, and I could take my trousers off and stand them in the corner. We were 30 miles from town, and the contractors really wanted to keep us there. They didn't want to do anything that would upset us, especially in terms of food. So there was buku food, not only in volume, but in choices. All family style, served on a huge plate, pork chops, meatloaf, chicken. I couldn't believe how fortunate I was. For a young fellow, there was sure a lot to be interested in. There were rumors that we might find some gold in the river and that the Bureau of Reclamation was going to keep all of it. We heard there was enough gold that got taken out of the river to pay for the whole dam. But I've done some research since then. Apparently, half the income from the gold would go to the contractor, and the other half went to the government. I never did hear how much they found, but I bet there was plenty.
Irene Takahashi. Before coming to live here, I was like a square in a round world. I'm American-born, second generation, but both of my parents came from Japan. I grew up in San Diego, but never felt like I fit with life in the city. When I married into the Takahashi family and my husband Ted started farming over here by the river, it was the life I needed. We started farming on the San Joaquin River in the early 1970s. That's when the gravel company asked us to come farm there, where the pits used to be. Ted knew the soil was like silt, river bottom soil, very good for what we wanted to raise. River bottom soil is rich, very rich. When we came out here, it was all still very pristine, even into the late 80s. There was a lot more wildlife then. The beavers were such mischievous critters, and there were deer and a lot of raccoons and muskrats. And there's a lot of history by this river. Lots of history and lots of, you know, spirits. Can I tell you a story? Can I tell you what I mean about spirits? We moved into a house that Mr. Gibson had built right on the river, a beautiful tile-roofed house. He'd built that house for his bride, but Mr. Gibson passed away before they got to live there together. His bride never got to live there at all. There was a lady who more or less lived with me then. She did the housework. We were close. We had some kind of relationship. I don't know what you'd call it, but we sensed things. I came home one day, and she was at the kitchen window. She had all of the doors locked. Her head was down, and she was scrubbing the same spot over and over. I said, "Emily, let me in." She shook her head. I finally convinced her to let me in. She said, "Irene, there's something in this house." She told me that she was putting the linen in the hall closet and looked up and saw something with a veil on, looking at her, just a head. I said, "That's funny, Emily, because the same thing happened to me." I'd been in the side bedroom one night, and I could see something moving, like leaves, in the same hallway. It was just a veil, floating, alone. It just floated there for a while, and there was nothing frightening about it. It didn't scare me. There was actually a kind of loneliness about it. I never imagine things, and I don't believe in ghosts. But this was like a presence. Emily and I thought it was trying to tell us something. We thought maybe it was a spirit of Mr. Gibson's bride. I went over to St. Agnes and bought a statue of a saint. I put it down in front of Emily to ease her apprehension and said, "Will you still work for me?" There was still a lot of native people around here when we first moved here, and I liked that. I always felt comfortable with Indians. They communicate in a very majestic way. When we first moved out here, one Indian man told me, "There's a fox with a white face that lives out here, and I honor that fox." Later, one of my sons ran into a hunter who had cornered a fox with a white face. The guy was going to kill it, but my son said, "No, this fox is honorable with the Indian people. His spirit is alive. You can't shoot him." My son understands about those things, too. I think the Indians have a good history. That's part of what makes this river a magical place. There's a special feeling out there on Rank Island. It's like a cathedral. For a while, we planted boysenberries on the island. It is another world, quiet and peaceful. There is an enchantment out here, all along the river. The Riverview Ranch House is another special place on the river. There is an old barn still standing out there, where lots of owls still live. One of our farm workers saw a white owl fly out of the barn, and he said it became a woman in white, maybe an angel. The man went right back to Mexico. There's a lot of history out here, a lot of spirit. I know I'm getting off the subject, but that is how it is up here. There's magic all around.
Elmer Hansen. I've spent a lot of time on rivers, pretty much my whole life. And I was always interested in fishing and boating, and girls, of course. A river is a great place for all of that. I moved to the San Joaquin River in 1929, before we had the dam at Millerton. The river looked entirely different in those days. When I was a little kid, water was a pretty big deal. Everybody had to hand pump the water out of a well. We carried water in buckets to the house to wash the dishes and heated it on the stove to wash our clothes. The washtub was our bathtub. We stood in it, and Mother sprinkled us with a wet rag and washed us from the head down. You had to carry water to the cattle, and if you had a family vegetable garden or a rose garden, all that would be hand-bucketed too. The irrigation districts in the valley were formed to help supply water for the grape vineyards that the Italians started planting here. The more vineyards they planted, the more water they needed, and that's when I came into the picture. I became involved with Peerless Pumps in the early 30s when we started installing deep well pumps. The water levels were getting lower, and we had to dig wells so that the deep pumping pillars had to lift the water instead of pulling it to overcome gravity. It was brand new technology, and once we started making the better pumps, the new grape varieties were introduced, and then citrus and nut trees, and they all had to have water. Even after the dam, farmers weren't assured enough water to irrigate through the entire growing season, so they had to supplement with all these well pumps to finish out their crops in the summer. In my 47 years with Peerless Pumps, we installed over 40,000 pumps. That changed everything for agriculture. Those pumps made it possible for this country to be what it is now. Thank you.
Smith. I'd like to begin my story way back in Los Angeles, where I grew up. We didn't live too far from the Los Angeles River, and I remember as a child looking at that poor, pathetic river and those enormous concrete banks. Apparently, the concrete was put in after a major flood in 1938 or 39. A lot of homes had been destroyed, and a few people had died. Actually, the concrete was pretty handy for a kid. I used to love to ride my bike up on the banks. But the fate of the Los Angeles River broke my heart. Even as a child, I could see how terrible that was. Many years later, after I moved to Fresno, I read a little article in the Bee. When I say little, I mean it was just barely a mention on page B9 or something. As a representative from the Ball family had asked for pre-approval of their large housing development project, and fortunately a reporter was there and wrote about the request. That was the beginning of my activism. When I heard that people were seriously considering putting houses in the San Joaquin River bottom, I thought, they'll put in the houses, there'll be a flood, and then the whole river bottom will be turned to concrete. That image was what really motivated me to get active. I was just totally blown away when I found out that people were proposing to put an urban neighborhood on that land. I thought, somebody needs to do something. The first developer who wanted to build on the Ball Ranch was a man who'd been a successful developer in Palm Springs. He seemed to think that everything in Fresno was pretty much like it was there, except that there happened to be a little trickle of a river here. By that time, I was on the River Committee's board of directors, and we were all invited on a tour of the Ball property. We went in a little bus, and I vividly remember the developer pointing out that he planned to tear out all those ugly shrubs over there. We were all saying, "No, no, no, the animals and birds need those shrubs." Then when the environmental impact report was released, the scientific part was absolutely awful. The River Committee was very active in responding to that report, and after that, the Palm Springs developer just disappeared. For a year or so, we actually thought it was possible that the Ball project wouldn't be revived, but it came back with even greater force. A much larger corporation with more money and expertise became a formidable enemy, and they stayed around for a very long time, and eventually they left too. But a few years later, another idea popped up, the Spano Ranch project, and somebody made a publicity film about the project. It was the most amazing propaganda I had ever seen. They claimed that the Spano Ranch project would be just a beautiful English village on the shores of the Thames River. It was a huge development with hotels and things. It showed such total disregard for the environmental facts. In 1986, a group from the River Committee went to a rally of the Land Trust Alliance. That was the beginning of the process of setting up the San Joaquin River Parkway and Conservation Trust. It was all about saving the land so that these wonderful wild areas like the messy, jungly, shrubby Ball Ranch would remain the way they were. I remember telling a friend, if we can get to the point where the idea of building houses in the river bottom is absolutely unthinkable to this community, then I'll feel that we have accomplished what we need to accomplish. The work continues.
Bernie Salado. We landed here in June of 1968. We came from Mexico. My dad brought his six kids and a wife. Imagine, I came from an area where I'd never seen a fruit tree. I'd never seen a car or a plane. We flew into Fresno at night. The next day we woke up and my dad took us to that pasture out there. All those fields were pastures then. There was a vineyard right there, and on the side of it, all fruit trees. My dad was irrigating that morning, and I'd never seen water come out of the ground like that. I was fascinated by the sight. He brought me into the orchards, and I saw my first fruit tree. We picked some fruit. It was like the Garden of Eden, paradise. Coming from a life with no electricity, no running water, and suddenly, here we are on this ranch by the river. It was like the Wizard of Oz, you know, where everything is black and white, and then you wake up one day and suddenly it's all in color. It was absolutely a paradise. A lot of people from my hometown in Mexico lived around this area. They worked for the Cobbs and the Coombs and the Ranks. My father and one of his cousins, who still lives down the street here, came here in the early 1940s as braceros, the work permit program back then. They worked in Fresno for a while, and then my dad went back to Mexico, got married, had his children, until one day he realized that their life in Mexico wasn't what he wanted for his family. He called his cousin to see how it was going here, and the cousin said, "Yeah, life is good. Come on up." It just takes one person to tell another person, and that's how so many people from my town migrated up here. Like so many other immigrants, it happened with the Armenians, the Italians. One family came and saw that the grapes were good, the olives, the strawberries. It's the same with the Japanese and the Chinese. That's how it happens. My dad broke horses for the Rank family. He made $1 an hour with 6 kids. But we had goats and pigs and cows and chickens and a giant garden. It was great. We never lacked for anything. You don't know you're poor until somebody tells you that you are. So we didn't know. There was always food on the table. We'd buy a 100-pound bag of beans, 100-pound bag of rice, 100 pounds of potatoes. Everything else was here. Eggs and meat and fruit and vegetables. And, of course, fish. Now, we weren't a fish-eating family when we first came here. We were from Jalisco in the middle of the high desert, very arid. There aren't any fish there. But on a river, there were always free fish in abundance. I remember just throwing a line in the river, and with just one quick jiggle, we'd catch fish all day long. Trout, bass, suckers. I was always amazed because on the school bus, we'd drop off kids at the estates with their big mansions and pools and nice cars. But those wealthier kids would ride their bikes all the way out here to spend time with us by the river. I was like, "Hey, what's the deal? You got air conditioning, you've got pools." I didn't understand it then, but now I know why they wanted to be here. We would come home after school and go straight down to the river. We'd float down the river, hang ropes in trees, and swing into the river. We'd see deer. One time we saw a little bear. Everything was spontaneous. We never said, "There's nothing to do." We were never bored. We'd hop on the horses that my dad broke and go riding by the river for hours. I remember riding by the river one day with my dad and thinking, "This is it. This is heaven."
Thank you so much, Elise Moyer, Cole Calloway, Donna Mott, and Kevin Statham for your fine reading of 10 excerpts from the book Take Me to the River by Coke and Joelle Halliwell. As we heard, the book features many of the unique stories written by folks who actually lived by the shores of the San Joaquin River from the earliest days right up to modern times. We heard about basket weaving as practiced by Native Americans, about the experiences of homesteading by early settlers, about mining for gold, heard about fishing for salmon, about what kind of wild and domestic animals abound near the river, about the stock market crash of 1929, about what kind of farming goes on near the river, about the growth of a very large water pump company, about the construction of Frye Dam, and about how the pressures to locate large housing developments near the river were rebuffed. These excerpts were collected and published by Coke Halliwell and her daughter, Joelle, in their recently published book entitled Take Me to the River. The stories that we heard were In Order Presented, written by Emily Sample, Everard Jones, Viola Adlesh, Bud Rank, Thelma Russell, Ken Homan, Irene Takahashi, Elmer Hansen, Peg Smith, and Bernie Salado. And let's not forget our fine readers, who were Elise Moyer, Coke Halliwell, Donna Mott, and Kevin Statham. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go on KVPR's website and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, we'll be hearing two stories, one by Stephen Gutierrez and the other by Charles Warnes. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.